As I approached the stone bridge over the river, I knelt beside a low, tightly cupped flower. Concentrating all my thoughts on the flower, I grew oblivious to everything else. The chilled air, the crying lambs, the smith's noises, all faded away. I studied the flower's lavender hue, touched on the east by the golden light of the emerging sun. Minuscule hairs, wearing droplets of dew, embroidered the edges of each petal, while a tiny brown aphid scurried across the collar of fringed leaves at the top of the stalk. Its aroma seemed fresh, but not sweet. Somehow I knew that its hidden center must be the color of aged yellow cheese. Ready at last, I began willing the flower to open. "Show yourself," I commanded. "Open your petals." I waited for a long moment. Nothing happened. Again, I focused on the flower. "Open. Open your petals." Still, nothing happened. I started to stand. Then, very slowly, the collar of leaves began to flutter as if touched by the barest of breezes. A moment later, one of the lavender petals stirred, unfurling an edge ever so slightly, before gradually beginning to open. Another petal followed, and another, until the whole flower greeted the oncoming dawn with petals outstretched. And from its center sprouted six soft sprigs, more like feathers than petals. Their color, like aged yellow cheese. A brutal kick struck me in the back. Coarse laughter filled the air, crushing the moment as swiftly as a heavy foot crushed the flower. Chapter 3. Riding the Storm. With a groan, I pushed myself to my feet. "Denatius, you pig!" The older boy, square-shouldered with bushy brown hair, smirked at me. "You're the one with pointed ears like a pig, or like a demon. Anyway, better a pig than a bastard." My cheeks grew hot, but I held my temper. I looked into his eyes, gray as a goose's back. This required me to tilt my head back since he was so much taller. Indeed, Denatius' shoulders could already lift loads that made many grown men wobble. In addition to stoking the smith's fire, hot, heavy work on its own, he cut and carried the firewood, worked the bellows, and hauled iron ore by the hundredweight. For this, the smith gave him a meal or two a day, a sack of straw to sleep on, and many a blow about the head. "I am no bastard." Denatius slowly rubbed the stubble on his chin. "Where, then, is your father hiding? Maybe he's a pig, or maybe he's one of those rats who lives with you and your mother."
"We don't have any rats in our home."
"Home? You call that a home? It's just a filthy hole where your mother can hide and do her sorcery." My fists clenched. The taunts about me cut deep enough, but it was his crass mention of her that made my blood boil. Still, I knew that Denatius wanted me to fight him. I also knew what the outcome would be. Better to hold my temper if I could. It would be very hard to keep my arms still, but my tongue even harder. "He who is made of air should not accuse the wind." "What do you mean by that, bastard whelp?" I had no idea where the words came from that I spoke next. "I mean that you should not call somebody else bastard, since your father was just a Saxon mercenary who rode through this village one night and left nothing but you and an empty flask in his wake." Denatius' mouth opened and then closed without a word. I realized that I had spoken words he had always feared but never admitted were true, words that struck more violently than clubs. His face reddened. "Not so. My father was a Roman and a soldier. Everyone knows that." He glared at me. "I'll show you who's the bastard." I stepped backward. Denatius advanced on me. "You are nothing, bastard. Nothing. You have no father, no home, no name. Where did you steal the name? Emrys bastard, you are nothing and you'll never be more. I winced at his words, even as I saw the rage swell in his eyes. I glanced about for some way to escape. I couldn't possibly outrun him, not without a head start. But there were no birds flying overhead today. A thought hit me. No birds flying overhead. Just as I had done yesterday, I pointed to the sky and cried out, "Look, treasure from the sky!" Dinacius, who had just leaned forward to lunge at me, did not look skyward this time. Instead, he hunched as if to protect his head from a blow. That was all that I could hope for. I turned and ran as fast as a frightened rabbit across the rain-soaked yard of the mill house. Roaring with rage, he flew after me. "Come back, coward!" I cut across the grass, leapt over a broken grinding stone and some scraps of wood, and dashed over the bridge, my leather boots slapping on the stones. Even before I reached the opposite side, I could hear Dinacius' footsteps above my own panting. Veering sharply, I turned up the old Roman road on the riverbank. To my right, the Tuas waters churned. To my left, dense forest stretched unbroken, except by the pathways of deer and wolves, all the way to the slopes of Ewythfa. I sped up the stony path for 60 or 70 paces, all the while hearing him draw closer. As I topped a small rise, I left the path, hurling myself into the thicket of bracken bordering the forest. Despite the thorns tearing into my calves and thighs, I plunged frantically ahead. Then, breaking free of the bracken, I jumped a fallen branch, leapt a rivulet, and scrambled up the mossy outcropping of rock on the other side. Finding a slender deer trail, winding like an endless snake along the forest floor, I raced along until I found myself in a grove of towering trees. I stopped just long enough to hear Dinacius crashing through the branches behind me. Without pausing to think, I crouched on the cushion of needles underfoot and sprung up to the lowest branch of a great pine tree. Like a squirrel, I worked my way upward, one branch after another, until I had climbed to the height of 3 men above the ground. At that very instant, Dinacius entered the grove. Directly above him, I clung to the branch, heart racing, lungs aching, legs bleeding. I tried to remain motionless, to breathe quietly, though my lungs screamed for more air. Dinacius stared to his left and to his right, straining to see in the dimly lit grove. At one point, he looked up, but caught a flake of bark in his eye and thundered, "Curse this forest!" Hearing some slight rustling beyond the grove, he threw himself in that direction. For most of the morning, I waited on that branch, observing the slow sweep of light over the needled boughs and the still slower movement of wind walking among the trees. At length, convinced that I had eluded Dinacius, I dared to move. But I did not climb down. I climbed up. Ascending the stairway of branches, I realized that my heart was still racing, though not with fear, nor with exertion. It pounded with anticipation. Something about this tree, this minute, thrilled me in a way I could not explain. Each time I tugged my body to a higher branch, I found my own spirits lifted as well. It was almost as if I could see farther, hear clearer, and smell deeper the higher I climbed. I imagined myself soaring beside the small hawk that I could see circling above the trees. The vista below me enlarged. I followed the course of the river as it wound its way down from the hills to the north. The river reminded me of a huge serpent, something out of Branwen's stories. And the hills sat in rumpled rows like the folds of an ancient, exposed brain. What thoughts, I wondered, had that brain produced over the great stretch of time? Was this forest one of them? Was this day one of them? Out of the mists curling among the steepest hills, rose the great mass of Ewythfa, its summit gleaming, cloaked in white. Cloud shadows, dark and round, moved across its ridges like the footprints of giants. If only I could see the giants themselves! If only I could witness their dance!
In the western sky, the clouds themselves gathered. Though I could still see the occasional glint and sparkle of light on the sunlit sea. The sight of the endless ocean filled me with a vague, indefinable longing. Somehow I knew. My true home, my true name, lay out there, somewhere. Currents as bottomless as the sea itself churned within me. Reaching for the next limb, I struggled to pull myself higher. I clasped my hands around the base of the branch, then threw one leg over. Several twigs broke off and spiraled gracefully to the ground. With a grunt, I pulled as hard as I could and finally mounted it. Ready to rest, I wedged myself into the notch of the branch and leaned back against the trunk. Feeling my hands so sticky from pine sap, I brought them to my face. I filled my lungs with the sweet, resiny smell. Suddenly, something brushed my right ear. I spun my head around. A bristling brown tail disappeared around the trunk. As I stretched to peer behind the trunk, I heard a loud whistle. The next instant, I felt tiny feet scamper lightly across my chest and down my leg. I sat up again, just in time to see a squirrel leap from my own foot to a lower branch. Grinning, I watched the bustling animal chatter and squeak. The squirrel dashed up the trunk and then down and then up again, waving its tail like a furry flag, all the while chewing on a pine cone almost as large as its head. Then, as if it had just noticed me, it stopped short. It considered me for a few seconds, squealed once, and jumped to the outstretched bough of a neighboring tree. From there, it scurried down the trunk and out of sight. I wondered whether I had looked as amusing to the squirrel as the squirrel had looked to me. The thrill rose in me again, driving me to climb. As the wind lifted, so did the elixir of scents from the trees. Resins from chafing branches on every side poured over me, immersing me in a river of aromas. Again, I saw the hawk still circling overhead. I could not be sure, but I felt somehow that it was watching me, observing me for reasons of its own. The first rumble of thunder came as I hauled myself up to the highest branch that could support my weight. With it came a rumble more powerful still, the collective calling of thousands of trees bending with the same wind. I gazed across the sea of trees, their branches rippling like waves on water. I found that beneath the rumble, I could hear their varying voices, the deep sighing of oak and the shrill snapping of hawthorn, the whooshing of pine and the cracking of ash. Needles clicked and leaves tapped. Trunks groaned and hollows whistled. All these voices and more joined to form one grand, undulating chorus, singing in a language not so distant from my own. As the wind swelled, my tree started to sway. Almost like a human body, it swung back and around, gently at first, then more and more wildly. While the swaying intensified, so did my fears that the trunk might snap and hurl me to the ground. But in time, my confidence returned. Amazed at how the tree could be at once so flexible and so sturdy, I held on tight as it bent and waved, twisted and swirled, slicing curves and arcs through the air. With each graceful swing, I felt less a creature of the land and more a part of the wind itself. The rain began falling, its sound merging with the splashing river and the singing trees. Branches streamed like waterfalls of green. Tiny rivers cascaded down every trunk, twisting through moss meadows and bark canyons. All the while I rode out the gale. I could not have felt wetter. I could not have felt freer. When at last the storm subsided, the entire world seemed newly born. Sunbeams danced on rain-washed leaves. Curling columns of mist rose from every glade. The forest's colors shone more vivid. Its smells struck more fresh. And I understood for the first time in my life that the earth was always being remade, that life was always being renewed, that it may have been the afternoon of this particular day, but it was still the very morning of creation. Chapter 4. The Rag Pile. Late afternoon light heightened the hues and deepened the shadows before I felt a subtle pang in my abdomen. Quickly, the pang grew. I was hungry, hungry as a wolf. Taking a last look at the vista, I could see a golden web of light creeping across the hills. Then I began to climb down from my perch. When at last I reached the bottommost branch, still wet from the rain, I wrapped my hands around the bark and let myself drop over the side. For a moment I hung there, swaying like the tree in the gale. For some reason, I realized, the usual ache between my shoulder blades had not bothered me since I had first ascended the branches. I let go, falling into the bed of needles. Gently, I placed my hand upon the ridged trunk of the old tree. I could almost feel the resins moving through the tall, columnar body, even as the blood moved through my own. With a simple pat of my hand, I gave thanks. My gaze fell to a bouquet of tan mushrooms wearing shaggy manes nestled among the needles at the base of the pine. From my forages with Bronwyn, I knew them to be good eating. I pounced. In short order, I had consumed every one, as well as the roots of a purple-leafed plant growing nearby. I found the deer trail and followed it back to the rivulet. Cupping my hands, I drank some of the cold water. It chilled my teeth and awakened my tongue. A new lightness in my step, I returned to the towpath leading to the village. I crossed the bridge. Beyond the mill, the thatched roofs of Caer Vedwyd clustered like so many bundles of dry grass. In one of them, the woman who called herself my mother was probably mixing her potions or tending to someone's wound, ever secretive and silent. To my own surprise, I found myself hoping that one day, this place might yet feel like home. Entering the village, I heard the playful shouts of other boys. My first impulse was to seek out one of my usual hideaways, yet I felt a new surge of confidence. This was a day to join in their games. I hesitated. What if Denatius was about? I would need to keep a wary eye on the smith's shop. Still, perhaps even Denatius might soften in time. Slowly, I approached. Beneath the great oak tree where the three main pathways converged, I saw farmers and merchants gathered peddling their goods. Horses and donkeys stood tethered to posts, their tails swishing at flies. Nearby, a bard with a somber face was entertaining a few listeners with a ballad, until one of the swishing tails slapped him right in the mouth. By the time he quit gagging and composed himself again, he had lost his audience. Four boys stood at the far side of the square, practicing their aim by throwing rocks and sticks at a target, a pile of torn rags stuffed against the base of the oak. When I saw that Denatius was not among them, I breathed easier. Soon I drew near enough to call out to one of the boys, "How is your throw today, Lude?" A squat, sandy-haired boy turned to me. His round face and small eyes gave him the look of being perpetually puzzled. Although he had not been unfriendly to me in the past, today he seemed cautious. I could not tell whether he was worried about Denatius or about me. I stepped nearer. "Don't worry. No birds are going to empty themselves on your head." Lude watched me for an instant, then started to laugh. "A good shot, that was." I grinned back. "A very good shot." He tossed me a small stone. "Why not try your aim?"
"Are you sure?" one of the other boys asked. "Denatius won't like it."
Lude gave a shrug.
"Go ahead, Emrys. Let's see you throw."
The boys traded glances as I hefted the stone in my palm. With a snap of my arm, I threw at the rag pile. The stone flew high and wide, hitting the goose pen and causing a great commotion of honking and flapping. I muttered sheepishly, "Not too good."
"Maybe you should get closer," ridiculed one of the boys. "Like right under the tree."
The others laughed. Lude waved them quiet and tossed me another stone.
"Try again. Some practice is what you need."
Something about his tone restored my confidence. As they all watched, I took aim again. This time, as I positioned myself, I took a moment to gauge the distance to the target and the weight of the stone in my hand. Keeping an eye on the pile of rags, I wound back my arm and released. The stone made a direct hit. Lewd clucked in satisfaction. I could not keep from smiling proudly. Then something odd caught my attention. Instead of sailing through the rags and hitting the trunk of the tree behind, my stone had bounced away as if the rags themselves were made of something solid. As I looked more closely, my heart missed a beat. For as I watched, the rag pile shifted. From it came a piteous groan.
"It's a person," I cried in disbelief.
Lude shook his head.
"That's no person," he waved carelessly at the rag pile. "That's a Jew."
"A filthy Jew,"
echoed one of the other boys. He hurled his own stone at the rags, another hit, another groan.
But you can't."
I started to say more, then caught myself. That would risk losing any chance I might have to be accepted by the group.
"Why not?"
Lude reared back to throw a weighty stick.
"The Jews should never have come through here. They are hellborn, like demons with horns and tails. They carry diseases,
bring bad luck."
The ragpile whimpered. I swallowed hard.
"I don't believe it. Why don't we let the beggar go and aim at something else instead?"
Lude eyed me strangely.
"You'd best not defend the Jew. People might wonder whether..."
He paused, picking his words.
"Whether you come from the same stock."
Before I could reply, Lude let fly the heavy stick. With a sweep of my arm, I cried out,
"No, don't hit him!"
The stick abruptly stopped its flight in midair and fell to the ground. It was as if the stick had slammed into an invisible wall of air. The boys stood astonished. My jaw dropped. I was no less amazed than they were.
"A spell," whispered one boy.
"Sorcery," said another.
Lude's round face whitened. Slowly, he backed away from me.
"Get away, you
demon's child,"
finished another voice. I turned to find myself face to face with Denatius, his tunic ripped and splattered with mud from his long trek through the forest. Despite his grimace, he looked satisfied at having cornered his prey at last. I straightened my back, which only made me more aware of his considerable size advantage.
"Let's not be enemies."
He spat on my cheek. "You think I would be the friend of a demon's whelp like you?" My dark eyes narrowed as I wiped my face clean. It was all I could do to contain my anger, enough to try again. My voice shaking, I declared,
"I am no demon. I am a boy just like you."
"I know what you are." Denatius' voice rolled down on me like a rock slide. "Your father was a demon, and your mother does the wicked work of demons. Either way, you are a child of the devil."
With a shout, I lunged at him. Deftly, Denatius stepped to one side, swung me into the air, and threw me hard to the ground. He kicked me in the side for good measure, sending me rolling in the dirt. I could barely sit up for the pain in my ribs. Above me towered Denatius, his bushy head thrown back in laughter. The other boys laughed too, even as they urged him on.
"What's your trouble, demon's child?" taunted Denatius.
Though my pain was great, my rage was greater. Clutching my side, I struggled to roll onto my knees, then rise to my feet. I growled like a wounded beast, then charged again, arms flailing. An instant later, I found myself face down in the grass, barely able to breathe. I could taste blood in my mouth. The thought of playing dead crossed my mind in the hope that my tormentor would lose interest, but I knew better. Denatius' laughter ceased as I forced myself to stand, blood trickling down my chin. I planted my unsteady feet and looked into his eyes. What I found there caught me off guard. Beneath his belligerence, he was clearly surprised.
"God's sweet death, but you're stubborn.
Stubborn enough to stand up to you, I replied hoarsely, my hands clenched into fists. At that moment, another figure swept out of nowhere to stand between us. The boys, except for Denatius, fell back, and I gasped in surprise. It was Branwen. Though a shadow of fear crossed his face, Denatius spat at her feet.
Move aside, she-demon.
Eyes alight, she glared at him.
Leave us.
Go to the devil, he retorted. That's where you both belong.
Is that so? Then it is you who had better flee.
She raised her arms menacingly.
Or I will bring the fires of hell down on you.
Denatius shook his head.
You will be the one to burn, not me.
But I am not afraid of fire. I cannot be burned.
Lud, watching Branwen nervously, pulled on Denatius' shoulder.
What if she speaks the truth? Let's go.
Not until I finish with our whelp. Branwen's blue eyes flashed.
Leave now or you shall burn.
He stepped backward. She leaned toward him, then spoke a single word of command.
Now!
The other boys turned and ran. Denatius, seeing their flight, looked uncertain. With both hands, he made the sign to protect himself from the evil eye.
Now!
Repeated Branwen. Denatius glowered at her for a moment, then retreated. I took Branwen's arm. Together we walked in slow procession back to our hut. Chapter 5. Sacred Time. Stretched out on my pallet, I winced as Branwen massaged my bruised ribs. Odd patches of light streaming through the holes in the thatched roof fell on her left shoulder and hand. Her brow wrinkled in concern. Those blue eyes studied me so intensely that I could almost feel them boring into my skin.
Thank you for helping me.
You're welcome.
You were wonderful, really wonderful. And you appeared just in time, out of empty air, like one of your Greek gods, Athena or somebody.
Branwen's wrinkles deepened.
More like Zeus, I'm afraid.
I laughed, which I regretted because it made my side hurt.
You mean you showered them with thunder and lightning?
Instead of wisdom,
she gave a sullen sigh.
I only did what any mother would do, even if you never...
What?
She shook her head.
It doesn't matter.
She rose to prepare a poultice that smelled of smoke and cedar. I heard her chopping and grinding for several minutes before returning to my side. Then, placing the poultice against my ribs, she laid her hands on top, pressing gently. Gradually, I felt a steady warmth flowing into my bones as if the marrow itself had turned into fire coals. In time, she closed her eyes and began to sing a low, slow chant that I had heard her use before in her healing work. In the past, I had never been sure whether she sang it to heal the person in her care or, in some way I could not understand, to heal herself. This time, studying her face, I had no doubt. The chant was for her, not for me.
He gadoden kot an hu, hud an kledri malwithan, gain ke ai bi clown won kobri, vari galdoan fin kaira, dravia fin kaira.
The words, I felt, came from another world, an ocean away. I waited until she opened her eyes, then asked what I had wondered so often before, not expecting to receive any answer.
What does it mean?
Again she examined me with eyes that seemed to pierce my very soul. Then, choosing her words with care, she replied,
It is about a place, a magical place, a land of allurement, and also illusion. A land called Finkaira.
What do those words at the end say? Dravia Finkaira?
Her voice dropped to a whisper.
Live long, Finkaira.
She lowered her eyes.
Finkaira, a place of many wonders, celebrated by bards of many tongues. They say it lies halfway between our world and the world of the spirit, neither holy of earth nor holy of heaven, but a bridge connecting both. Oh, the stories I could tell you! Its colors are more bright than the brightest sunrise, its air more fragrant than the richest garden. Many mysterious creatures are found there, including, legend has it, the very first giants.
Shifting my hips on the straw, I rolled so that my face was closer to hers.
You make it sound like a real place.
Her hands tightened against my ribs.
No more than any other place I've told you stories about. Stories may not be real in the same way as this poultice, my son, but they are real nonetheless. Real enough to help me live and work and find the meaning hidden in every dream, every leaf, every drop of dew.
You don't mean that stories like the ones about the Greek gods are true?
Oh, yes.
She thought for a moment.
Stories require faith, not facts, don't you see? They dwell in sacred time, which flows in a circle, not historical time, which runs in a line. Yet they are true, my son, truer in many ways than the daily life of this pitiful little village.
Puzzled, I frowned.
But surely the Greeks' mountain Olympus is not the same as our mountain Iwithpa.
Her fingers relaxed slightly.
They are not so different as you think. Mount Olympus exists on land and in story, in historical time and in sacred time. Either way, Zeus and Athena and the others can be found there. It is an in-between place. Not quite our world and not quite the other world, but something in between. In the same way that mist is not really air and not really water, but something of both. Another place like that is the Isle of Delos, the Greek island where Apollo was born and makes his home.
In story, sure, but not in reality.
She eyed me strangely.
Are you sure?
Well, no, I guess not. I've never been to Greece, but I've seen Iwithpa 100 times right out that window. There are no Apollos walking around here, not on that mountain, and not in this village.
Again, she eyed me strangely.
Are you sure?
Of course I'm sure.
I grasped a handful of straw from my pallet and threw it in the air.
This is the stuff of this village. Dirty straw, broken walls, angry people, ignorant too. Why, half of them think you really are a sorceress.
Lifting the poultice, she examined the bruise running down my ribs.
Yet they still come here to be healed.
She reached for a wooden bowl containing a greenish-brown paste that smelled pungent like overripe berries. Tenderly, using 2 fingers of her left hand, she began to apply the paste to my bruise.
Tell me this,
she said without taking her eyes off my wound.
Have you ever been out walking away from the clatter of the village when you felt the presence of a spirit of something you couldn't quite see? Down by the river, perhaps, or somewhere in the forest?
My thoughts drifted back to the great pine tree swaying in the storm. I could almost hear the swishing of branches, the wafting of resins, the feeling of bark on my hands.
Well, sometimes in the forest?
Yes. I felt as if the trees, the oldest trees especially, were alive, not just like a plant, but like a person, with a face, with a spirit.
Branwen nodded.
Like the dryads and hamadryads.
She gazed at me wistfully.
I wish I could read to you some of the stories about them in the Greeks' own words. They tell them so much better than I can. And those books, Emrys, I have seen a room full of books so thick and musty and inviting that I would sit down with one on my lap and do nothing but read all day long. I would keep on reading late into the night until I fell asleep. And then, as I slept, I might be visited by the dryads or by Apollo himself.
She stopped short.
Have I never told you any stories about Dagda?
I shook my head.
What does that have to do with Apollo?
Patience.
Taking another scoop of the paste, she continued working.
The Celts, who have lived in Gunith long enough to know about sacred time, have many Apollos of their own. I heard about them as a child long before I learned to read.
I jolted.
You are Celtic? I thought you came from wherever I came from, over the sea.
Her hands tensed.
I did, but before I went there, I lived here, in Gunith. Not in this village, but in Caer Mirthin, which was not so crowded as it is today. Now, let me continue.
I nodded obediently, feeling buoyed by what she had said. It wasn't much, but it was the first time she had ever told me anything about her childhood. She resumed both her work and her story.
Dagda is one of those Apollos. He is one of the most powerful Celtic spirits, the god of complete knowledge. What does Dagda look like? In the stories, I mean.
Branwyn took the last of the paste from the bowl.
Ah, that's a good question. A very good question. For some reason known only to him, Dagda's true face is never seen. He assumes various forms at various times. Like what? Once, in a famous battle with his supreme enemy, an evil spirit named Rita Gaur, both of them took the forms of powerful beasts. Rita Gaur became a huge boar with terrible tusks and eyes the color of blood.
She paused, trying to remember.
Oh, yes. And a scar that ran all the way down one of its forelegs.
I stiffened. The scar under my eye, where the boar's tusk had ripped me 5 years ago, started to sting. On many a dark night since that day, the same boar had appeared again and attacked again in my dreams.
And in that battle, Dagda became a great stag,
I completed.
Bronze in color, except for the white boots, 7 points on each side of its rack, and eyes as deep as the spaces between the stars.
Surprised, she nodded.
So you have heard the story?
No, I confessed.
Then how could you know?
I exhaled long and slow.
I have seen those eyes.
She froze.
You have?
I have seen the stag and the boar as well.
When?
On the day we washed ashore. She studied me closely.
Did they fight?
Yes, the boar wanted to kill us. Especially you, I would guess, if it really was some kind of evil spirit.
Whatever makes you say that?
Well, because you were you, and I was just a scrawny little boy then. I cast an eye over myself and grinned. As opposed to the scrawny big boy I am now. Anyway, that boar would surely have killed us. But then the stag appeared and drove it off. I touched the spot under my eye. That's how I got this.
You never told me.
I glanced at her sharply.
There is much you have never told me. You're right, she said ruefully. We may have shared a few stories about others, but very few about ourselves. It's my fault, really.
I said nothing.
But I will share this much with you now. If that boar, Rita Gaur, could have killed just one of us, it would not have been me. It would have been you.
What? That's absurd. It's you who has such knowledge, such powers to heal.
And you have powers more vast by far.
Her gaze locked into mine.
Have you begun to feel them yet? Your grandfather told me once that his came in his 12th year. She caught her breath. I did not mean to mention him.
But you did.
Now can you tell me more?
Grimly, she shook her head.
Let's not talk about it. Please, oh please, tell me something at least. What was he like? I can't.
My cheeks grew hot.
You must. Why did you mention him at all unless there was something about him I should know?
She ran a hand through her yellow locks.
He was a wizard, a formidable one. But I will tell you only what he said about you, before you were born. He told me that powers such as he possessed often skipped a generation, and that I would have a son who...
Who what?
who would have powers even greater than his own, whose magic would spring from the very deepest sources, so deep that, if you learned to master them, you could change the course of the world forever.
My jaw fell open.
That's not true, and you know it. Just look at me. I am, she said quietly. And while you are not now what your grandfather described, perhaps you will be someday.
No, I protested. I don't want that. I only want my memory back. I want to know who I really am.
What if who you are involves such powers?
How could it? I scoffed. I'm no wizard.
She cocked her head.
One day, you might be surprised.
Suddenly I remembered what had happened to Lude's stick.
Well, I was surprised out there before you came.
Something strange happened. I'm not even sure I did it. But I'm not sure I didn't, either.
Without saying a word, she retrieved a torn piece of cloth and started wrapping it around my ribs. She seemed to be observing me with new respect, perhaps even a touch of fear. Her hands moved more gingerly, as if I were almost too hot to touch. Whatever she was feeling, whatever I was sensing, it made me very uncomfortable. In the same moment that I had started to feel closer to her, it made her seem more distant than ever. At length, she spoke.
Whatever you did from your powers. They are yours to use, a gift from above, from the greatest of the gods, the one I pray to more than any other, the one who gave each of us whatever gifts we have. I have no idea what your powers might be, my son. I only know that God didn't give them to you without expecting you to use them. All God asks is that you use them well. But first you must, as your grandfather put it, come to master them. And that means learning how to use them with wisdom and love. But I didn't ask for powers, nor did I, just as I did not ask to be called a sorceress. But with every gift comes the risk that others may not understand it. Aren't you afraid, though? Last year, in Clane, they burned someone they said was a sorceress.
She raised her eyes to the shafts of light coming through the holes above our heads.
Almighty God knows I am no sorceress. I only try to use whatever gifts I may have as best I can.
You try to blend the old wisdom with the new, and that frightens people.
Her sapphire eyes softened.
You see more than I realize. Yes, it frightens people. So does almost everything these days.
She gently tied off the bandage.
The whole world is changing, Emrys. I have never known a time like this, even in the other place. Invasions from across the sea, mercenaries whose loyalties shift overnight, Christians at war with the old beliefs at war with the Christians. People are afraid, deathly afraid. Anything unknown becomes the work of demons.
Stiffly, I sat up.
Don't you sometimes wish...
My voice disappeared and I swallowed.
That you didn't have your gifts, that you weren't so different, that nobody thought you were a demon. Of course.
She bit her lip thoughtfully.
But that's where my faith comes in. You see, the new wisdom is powerful, very powerful. Just see what it did for Saint Brigid and Saint Colombe. Yet I know enough about the old wisdom to know it has great power too. Is it too much to hope that they can live together, old and new? That they can strengthen each other? For even as the words of Jesus touch my soul, I cannot forget the words of others. The Jews, the Greeks, the Druids, the others even older.
I watched her somberly.
You know so much.
Not like me.
There you are wrong. I know so little, so very little.
A sudden look of pain crossed her face.
Like, why you never call me mother?
An arrow jabbed my heart.
That is because... Yes? Because I really don't believe you are.
She sucked in her breath.
And do you believe that your true name is Emrys?
No.
Or that my true name is Branwen?
No. She tilted her head upward. For a long moment she stared into the thatch over our heads, blackened with the soot of countless cooking fires. At length she looked at me again.
"About my own name, you are right. After we landed here, I took it from an old legend."
"The one you told me? About Branwen, daughter of Clear?"
She nodded.
"You remember it? Then you remember how Branwen came from another land to marry someone in Ireland. Her life began with boundless hope and beauty. And ended,"
I continued,
"with so much tragedy. Her last words were, 'Alas that I was ever born.'"
She took my hand in her own.
"But that is about my name, not yours. My life, not yours. Please believe what I'm telling you. Emrys is your name, and I am your mother."
A sob rose inside my throat.
"If you are really my mother, can't you tell me where my home is? My true home, the place I really belong?" "No, I can't. Those memories are too painful for me and too dangerous for you."
"Then how do you expect me to believe you?"
"Hear me, please. I don't tell you only because I care for you. You lost your memory for a reason. It is a blessing."
I scowled.
"It is a curse."
She watched me, her eyes grown misty. It seemed to me that she was about to speak, to tell me at last what I most wanted to know. Then her hand squeezed mine, not in sympathy, but in fright.